This is Car Expert.
We were so far up the RS6's bumper that it was kind of embarrassing. That's how quick this thing is.
I think it's actually a sign of resurgence for Nissan.
You're basically running a slick tyre with 650 horsepower and 1,000 newton-metres of torque on gravel.
If you are looking for a 4x4 that's not just a sort of soft roader, the Pagani Sport's definitely worth looking at.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of Car Expert. My name is Mandy Turner. I'm joined by Paul Marrick.
Mandy, how are you?
I'm good. And Scott Colley.
Hey, guys. It's good to be back.
Same here as well.
I know. It's
really deja vu.
Yeah, it's really good to have a familiar voice back here, Mandy. And your voice is so soothing.
Aw.
I listen to it in the bath. It's wonderful.
We've been recording for 30 seconds. 25 seconds of that have been the podcast. And we are off the air.
Just kidding. No, look, we started off with the first episode just introducing people to the fact that Car Expert exists and why we started it. And I guess this is officially episode one of the actual podcast where you can come and get your news fix. Now, you'll notice as well that we won't be releasing this at 12 p.m. on a Thursday or some specific time. We'll aim to get it out on Mondays, but maybe sooner, maybe later. I found that over the past 6 months, I don't know if you guys are the same, but I've been listening to a lot of podcasts and I find myself not really worrying about when the podcast comes out. It just comes out and I listen to it when it does. So,
well, you get the notification for it usually, so you don't need to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. That's my theory anyway. Yeah. So I think that is all good. And look, we'll have everyone from the team on the podcast regularly. We're going to be rotating through everyone and Mandy's going to be hosting it and driving the ship as well. So it should be really good fun.
Mm. It's been a while since I've spoken to you, Paul. How are your fleet of cars going?
Oh, good, good. I haven't driven the Supra for about a month now, and I can't get near the Tesla because my wife is always in it. So great, Mandy. Thanks for asking.
Sorry, no, Paul, look, just quickly, weren't you driving the Tesla? I'm just going to dive deep into my memory. It was so long ago. Last night, I think?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, last night. Yeah.
Yes, I was. We're actually, just before we sort of kick on with the news, we're actually out last night filming a piece of content that will be coming out soon. And it was we're outside very late and it was freezing, like 2 degrees or something. And what I like about the Tesla and just electric cars in general, it was kind of the go-to point for everyone to stay warm because you could have the heater running and everything was sort of operating normal without the thing being noisy or pumping out smoke and ruining our shots. So, yeah, the advantages of an electric car.
It also has some of the best seat heaters in the game. And while you were out filming, JWo and I could sit him in the diagonal back left seat and me in the driver's seat, so we were a distance apart, fiddle with all the settings and make the car fart when the indicators come on and all sorts of fun things. We really did mess with Paul's car. It was great.
Set the open fire on, get all nice and toasty and romantic.
We did, but we couldn't cuddle, unfortunately, this time. That'll have to wait.
Have you driven much of your HSV, your 93 one, Paul?
No. So the problem with that car is I've got it on Club Reg, which is the red registration plates in Victoria that you have a logbook for. The problem with all this COVID stuff at the moment is up until recently, you weren't allowed to go for drives for the sake of going for a drive. So my car's stored at one of my brother's warehouses, so it's sort of it's tricky for me to get down there at the moment because it's in an area that I'm not allowed to go to. And then if I drive the car that I'm not allowed to drive, it's sort of, yeah, I'm running the risk of getting into trouble. But we do have a video planned with that car soon. So keep an eye out for that. And I can't wait to get back into it.
Cool. What about you, Scully? Are you still riding your bicycle or have you actually bought yourself a car?
No, my car plans are on hold at the moment. I'm still looking for a good BMW 318 IS for less money than people want for them. So if you'd like to give me a really cheap car, please give me a call. But I have got a lot of Ks in on the bike recently, done a couple of 100K rides and a couple a little bit shorter than that. It's a good way to pass the time on a weekend where there's not a heap else to do. But it's also meant that I've been able to enjoy some really nice, you know, press cars recently and be able to park them in my garage where my pride and joy will or would eventually sit when I get it.
Oh, boy. It's good to have the team back. We might get stuck into some news now. I noticed, Scully, that Nissan have revealed a brand new electric SUV and, boy, it's stunning.
It is. So, yeah, Nissan is sort of has up until recently been known for being quite conservative with its design, and the Leaf, despite being one of the real pioneering electric cars of the industry, despite, you know, Tesla grabbing the headlines and taking the lead in the sales, the Leaf was one of the first, in fact, it was the first mainstream electric vehicle. It's always been a bit plain, whereas this Aria SUV, it looks just like a concept. It looks fantastic. And the numbers that Nissan is quoting would make it really competitive with the Tesla Model Y and the Ford Mustang Mach-E. It'll be available with a 65 kilowatt hour or a 90 kilowatt hour battery, and you can have it with two-wheel drive or all-wheel drive. So the fastest model will do 0 to 100 in just over 5 seconds, and it has 290 kilowatts and 560 newton meters. And the most efficient model is a 90 kilowatt hour battery, front-wheel drive with 178 kilowatts and 300 newton meters. And it'll do 610 kilometers on the Japanese test cycle, which is quite generous compared to the European one.
Well, the thing that actually surprises me most with this car is I think it's actually a sign of resurgence for Nissan, because look at that interior. That looks sensational. And the fact that this looks so much like the concept is a really positive sign of where Nissan is heading. Everything about this really actually looks pretty impressive. The range, the way that it charges, everything really hits the markers that it needs for a proper electric car. So I don't know. I'm really keen to drive it. I just hope that, you know, they just don't have the issues they had with the early Leaf products where, you know, they had battery degradation problems and issues with overheating because it wasn't cool. They went to great lengths here to actually talk about the liquid cooling in the batteries. So I think they have addressed that. But I don't know. I'm excited.
It's a sign of what's to come from Nissan. We've also seen the new X-Trail. We know the 400Z is coming. It's really nice to see what was once a really innovative and interesting brand, and its tagline has always been, or for a long time in Australia, has been innovation that excites. It's nice to see it coming back to that a little bit and trying to take some leadership, because it's been a bit of a shame seeing, you know, none of them are bad cars per se. They're all practical and reliable from what we understand, but there's not been a Nissan that I've walked into a showroom besides maybe the GTR and gone, I really want that. That's really appealing. And the Aria, the X-Trail, and what we're expecting from the 400Z show that that's changing.
What do you reckon the price bracket might be once they release pricing?
So based on Japanese pricing, it would kick off around $65,000 Australian and run up to, we're expecting, around $100,000 Australian. That's purely a guess based on the exchange rate, based on what we think the dual motor all-wheel drive will cost. And it's also worth bearing in mind that in markets like Japan, there are big EV subsidies. So in Japan, $67,000 Australian is actually $62,000 Australian once the subsidy comes into play. I personally, if it were to come to Australia, and Nissan's sort of indicated that it wants it, but getting it may be challenging in the next 12 months, I would expect them to pitch it as quite a premium offering, and yeah, start pricing around that sort of $70,000 mark and run right up as a big sort of flagship with the dual motor all-wheel drive system, because it looks good enough and it has the tech to actually get away with it. Why wouldn't you, you know, offer it to early adopters who've got some money to spend?
Scott, I've got an issue though. Why is it, you mentioned there that it may not come. This is something we hear quite a lot now with manufacturers where, I don't know, because Australia doesn't have any like legal requirements and they also work on an average fleet emissions in Europe, that they're trying to send all of their electric and hybrid cars to Europe instead of Australia. And for that reason, we're missing out on a lot of them. Do you think that's going to become a bigger issue, and should Australia actually be doing more about getting tighter emissions here so that we do actually get new cars that aren't just stuff that's left over for manufacturers?
Yes to all of the above. So it's been a problem for Volkswagen for quite a while, and Volkswagen has been quite vocal about it, but other manufacturers are finding the same thing now. And essentially, these electric vehicles are coming from factories that have a limited capacity, as all factories do, but also because it's quite early in their production cycles, car makers don't necessarily know what the demand is going to be. So initially with cars like the Kia e-Niro and the Volkswagen e-Golf, the problem wasn't so much that Australia's emission standards weren't very good, but it was that demand in Europe was so good and there was such a backlog that they couldn't actually get it to Australia because they couldn't build enough and it wasn't worth making it right-hand drive yet because demand was strong. But we've now reached a point in Europe where come the start of next year, there'll be stricter fleet emissions targets for all the car makers, and they'll be fined if their average fleet emissions go over a certain point. And the best way to bring them down is plug-in hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles. Whereas in Australia, we have far more relaxed emissions rules, and so it's less of a problem for car makers. So if you're Nissan or your Volkswagen or your Kia, and you're only able to build 100,000 as a purely arbitrary number, examples of your electric car every year, they're going to direct those to the markets where they have to sell them because the demand is there. And if they don't sell them, then the collective emissions of their fleet of cars might drift over the point that's been laid down, and they might get slugged with massive fines. So essentially, because our government isn't saying we need them, we're not getting them and other markets are.
We can only keep our fingers crossed, can't we? Now, I haven't found anyone who is not against the 2021 Ford Bronco. It's been revealed, and I am so in love with one. I want one, Paul.
Mandy, I think the only people that don't like it are the legally blind, because it is it is the most badass-looking car I've ever seen. And what I love about this the most is that we first saw this car probably a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, as a very early prototype at a proving ground. And that was a Ranger that was sort of chopped in half and shortened a little bit. And it looked pretty impressive then. This production version looks just absolutely stupidly cool. Now, what are we talking about? The Ford Bronco has been released. It's available in a two-door, a four-door, and also as a Bronco Sport, which is on a smaller platform. The Bronco two and four-door are both based on the T6 or a version of the T6 platform, which is the platform that was developed here in Australia for the Ranger and the Everest, and also the platform that forms the basis of the Ranger in the US and now the Bronco. Now, this is exciting because, in my mind anyway, the fact that this is based on the T6 platform means that there is the slightest remote possibility that this could come to Australia. And we ran an exclusive story a couple of weeks ago that Ford had an investor slide that suggested the F-150 and Bronco could be launched in right-hand drive markets. So Let's hope and cross our fingers and toes that it does come. What are we talking about, though? It is a vehicle that comes with one of two engine options, either a four-cylinder EcoBoost turbocharged petrol engine. This is currently the one that's used in the Ranger. It's a 2.3-litre. Just over 200 kilowatts of power, 420 newton meters of torque. But we also exclusively revealed that this car would be getting a EcoBoost V6, a 2.7 litre. That makes 231 kilowatts of power and 540 newton meters of torque, available with a 10-speed auto for the V6 and the EcoBoost. And more impressively, a 7-speed manual transmission for the smaller EcoBoost engine that has a crawler gear in it as well. It is just a really cool looking thing. For those who want something smaller, the Bronco Sport is also available. Comes with two engines, a 2-litre or a 1.5-litre turbo. This car's cute, but I don't think it's anywhere near as brash or cute as the bigger Bronco.
Do you actually think that these will get used as off-roads, though?
Absolutely not.
Mm. Yeah.
I think, to be a little bit less blunt than Paul, the big Bronco, the proper Big Daddy Bronco, not the Bronco Sport, which is a Ford Escape with some, you know, more off-road capable stuff underneath, it probably will be used off-road because it's a Jeep Wrangler rival and Jeep owners genuinely do go off-roading with their cars when they're not pretending to be Malibu Barbie. But yeah, the Bronco Sport, I'd be staggered if people are taking those all that far off-road. It does seem like a lifestyle-y sort of car more than an off-road car.
I look at this Bronco and I get the feeling that if this, for whatever reason, passes crash testing and doesn't roll over like the Wrangler did in crash tests, I think this could be days numbered for the Wrangler because, yeah, the Wrangler has your Mopar freaks who love modifying them and they always will. But for the type of person who just wants to be seen like they're doing stuff, this is, well, it obviously hasn't been crash tested yet, but if it is a decent car to crash test, there is a chance that this will take a serious amount of sales away from FCA.
Quick question for both of you. What the hell are goat modes?
This is something that I didn't really know was a thing, but GOAT, does that refer to, was that a Michael Jordan thing?
So it's an abbreviation in sort of pop culture and sport for greatest of all time, the Australian cricket team calls Nathan Lyon because he's Australia's most successful off-spinner. And then obviously the debate in the US is Michael Jordan or LeBron, who's the greatest basketballer of all time.
That's it. So what they've done here with the forward to kind of have a dig at the Wrangler is they've got a goat mode, which, oh, well, it's not even a mode. It's just a description. It goes over all terrain. And clearly that is just the most made up thing so that they could use goat on this car. But I love Ford's marketing department are geniuses. They kind of coined the term drift mode with Focus RS, and that's now been picked up by virtually every other manufacturer. There's a jump mode in the F-150 Raptor. They have the Baja mode in the Ranger Raptor. These are guys that they even call their engines stupid things like Power Stroke. I mean, I don't even know what that is, and I want one of those. It sounds impressive. So
Thursday night for you, Paul.
So, yeah, I think that Ford's marketing department does such a good job, and now they're backing it up with, look, and we have to not be too humble with this. A lot of the engineering work for this car has been done in Australia, and, you know, this is a cool car, and I love the fact that Australian engineers were involved in this and played some part in creating what could be the most highly anticipated launch of this year.
Yeah. How soon do you reckon we'll know if it's going to come to Australia?
Good question. Look, I don't know, but I know that we can cherry pick things off it. So We ran another exclusive story a while back regarding the next generation of Ranger and Everest, and we reported that it would get Sync 4. You can see what Sync 4 looks like in this, and you can see it's integrated into the center of the car there. It is a giant screen. Sync 4 will bring an all-new level of interactivity as well. So, look, it is exciting, and I think that parts of this car are just real highlights of things to come.
Yeah, cannot wait. Moving on, Scully, what is Stellantis?
Stellantis.
There's a cream for that.
Oh, my God. I was going to say it sounds like a Christopher Nolan film starring Matthew McConaughey. but it's actually the name for the combined PSA and FCA, or Peugeot, Citroen and Fiat Chrysler company, when the merger goes through. So
how did they get that name, though?
It's funny you ask. I think Carlos Tavares, who's the boss, reached into a bucket and pulled some letters out. So rather than go with Will Stopford, I want to pronounce that correctly. In his opener, has gone FCPSA, PSFCA, PSAFCA. Rather than go for a sort of alphabet soup combination of both abbreviations,
yeah.
Apparently Stellantis comes from the word stello, the Latin word, which means to brighten with stars. And it hasn't really explained the antis. So as best we can tell, it's just a cool word.
Is it?
Maybe said in a French, Italian or American accent, which I suppose is a great play in PSA and FCA. Maybe it is. I don't know.
Oh, God.
They've gone a slightly different approach, though, because, I mean, Renault, Nissan, Mitsubishi Alliance is quite a pain to write, whereas Stellantis will at least make me feel like I'm covering something, you know, even more exciting than cars.
Okay. I think it is worth pointing out as well, I forgot to mention this earlier, that if you do have any feedback for us or want anything in particular on the podcast, podcast@carexpert.com.au is our email address, or you can hit us up through the website as well.
And that's where you keep up to date with all
you. Why don't you say that on the back of a segment about a car company called Stellantis?
Send those emails through. Our first guest is no stranger to the motorsport world. World Rally Championship and World Rally Cross driver Chris Atkinson has joined Car Expert, and he joins us right now. Hello, Chris, or Atco, as most people know you.
How you doing, Mandy?
Okay, Atco. I know you. Mandy knows you. But for the listeners that don't, what's your driving history? What have you been involved in, and what do you like driving in your spare time?
Lots to go through in that first question there. There's a bit to it. I was thinking the other day, I've been racing since 2001 professionally, So nearly 20 years, which is crazy, like when you look back at it like that. And I started racing late compared to most people. I was doing motocross when I was at school, a few too many broken bones, and my parents said, you've got to focus on your schooling. And I actually went to university. I got a scholarship to Bond University and started finance accounting there. And while I was there, my brother got into rallying. go back a few years before that. My dad was a rally driver in the early 80s, but I would have been like 2 or 3 years old, so I vaguely remember it. So my brother was a bit older and remembered that, so he decided, oh, I'm going to go rallying. I had a go one day, and it was actually Neil Bates's brother, Rick, was doing a rally school, and I went up and down the road, and Rick goes, oh, how long have you been racing for? And I go, I've never driven on dirt before. And he goes, oh, you probably shouldn't say that. Oh, you're a fair bit quicker than your brother, who'd been racing for a while. You should maybe give it a go. And then after a bit of advice from some good guys, obviously Rick and Neil Bates, and then a few of the other Australian Championship guys that Dad sort of knew from the years back, we sort of went straight in the deep end. And after a year and a half, I was picked up by Suzuki, so for Monster Tajima, to go and do the Asia Pacific Championship for them. That escalated into going to the World Rally Championship with Subaru a couple of years later. A few years there, the GFC sort of put an end to my WRC main full-time career, with Subaru pulling out of motorsport and a couple of years out of the sport. But I continue to have like drives occasionally in the World Championship, in the Asia Pacific Championship, which we won. Raced in China a lot for VW and Skoda, and raced for Proton, raced for Citroen in the World Rally Championship, raced with Ken Block in the Monster Energy team. There's probably a few I'm missing. And then while I was racing for Volkswagen China, actually with the ProDrive guys who used to run the WRC team with Subaru, got a chance to go test the rallycross car for Subaru America, and a flight over there to test the car turned into a much longer trip and me racing for the team for the next 4 years. And here I am. We're not racing much this year, but hopefully back racing maybe later this year and possibly and hopefully next year.
That the rallycross stuff is fascinating. When did that become a thing? Because that seems to be like a mix between tarmac racing and then off-roading all in the one setting.
Yeah, I think it was actually really big in the 70s in Australia. So it was a sport that obviously around Scandinavia, but also in Australia, like guys like Brocky, Colin Bond, all those boys used to race. You know, they do Bathurst, they do rallycross, and they do rally back then. They were just like full multitaskers. Wow. And it started building momentum with sort of, hard to say, but like 2010 on, there was a bit of interest. And then when guys like my old teammate, Petter Solberg, and that started to really push, and then the manufacturers started to get involved, and it went up a big notch. The problem when manufacturers get involved, it starts to become an expensive sport. And when you're talking these 650 horsepower, 2 liter supercars, they're pretty much stretched to the limit. So it became an expensive sport. It was always more a sort of privateers battle, and they just took it up another notch. But it is entertaining. Like, there's such intense races to be involved in. Like, you're 0 to 100 in 2 seconds and you've got 10 cars on the grid. And pretty much very limited rules in terms of contact. So it's entertaining. You've got big jumps. You've got a mixture of surfaces, tarmac, gravel. So it's quite hard to set the cars for this, because you're basically running a slick tyre with 650 horsepower and 1,000 newton meters of torque on gravel. So you're like, how do I make this thing actually get around a corner? So it's a good challenge. And for me, probably at the stage of my career where I'd rallied for like 18 years, it was nice to move into something different and keep the motivation going, which it's definitely done.
Atco, what's the thing that you love most about rallying? Like, when you get in the driver's seat, what goes through your mind?
I think for me it's quite clear, and especially when I was younger and definitely had no care. I think to know, especially on a fast stage, to know that you're faster than anyone else in the world down that piece of road, that, and like a gnarly, awesome piece of road, that's a cool sensation. Like, you've got so much going on, so much risks, just things happening the whole time. I don't think you can beat that level of intensity and focus, probably in any other sport, definitely any other motorsport, but in any sport that is so intense for that period, and then you know you're the best at that, down that section of road in the world, then that's sort of what motivated me.
I think you rally drivers are actually insane because you look at most motorsport and let's be honest, like it is hard work, absolutely, but they're on a racetrack. There's limits to the racetrack and it's all fairly civilized in the grand scheme of things. You do a rally stage and holy shit, some of the crashes you see are insane. Just the fine close cutting of corners near giant trees. It is just unbelievable. And does it take you a long time to build up to the bravery of actually being able to go into full attack mode when you have all that stuff around you?
I think I was the other way. So I had no problem going to full attack mode. Then I just had to stop crashing. So, which is probably a good way to be because it's at least you know you can already do it. So it's just now just do it for every corner, not like 80% of the corners. So that was my approach. And even when I'd start a stage in the world championship, like when we were sort of always fighting for podiums, like right at the front, my strategy, pretty much to know that you're on the pace, if you hadn't had a moment, a scary moment, not that you get scared, but, you know, a proper moment in the first kilometer, you probably weren't going quick enough to be at the front. And that's basically your barometer for whether you're taking enough risk or not. Like when... I remember doing stages and I was not quite there with Loeb and Gronholm at Rally Finland and we sort of settled for our third place. We were like, okay. And I was still pushing pretty hard and you can see where the boys in front, the lines they're taking, you know, because it'd run in road position. So it would be, say, Gronholm first, Loeb second, me third. And you see the risk and you get to a point where you can drive at like 98% and still do a good stage time without massive risk. And then I'm watching these two boys fight for the win and they are cutting every corner, hitting every bank on every corner for 20 kilometers and they do a time within a tenth of a second. And you're just like, you know, that is so much commitment. Like no one could probably actually even grasp it unless you've done it to the level of intensity that is.
Well, it kind of makes the involvement you have with us sound very tame and boring then because, you know.
I've got to sit in a car with our boys.
Oh, my God. I'm glad I'm not the only one that's terrified of driving.
No, he's actually all right. I'm actually surprisingly comfortable with him because I think he somehow values his own life.
Just not yours.
Yeah, maybe not mine.
Well, just to sort of fill everyone in, ATCO is involved in basically being our performance editor, and that involves ATCO. You know, we do all the BAU stuff. How does a car drive on the road? What's it like to park? How many cup holders are there? But ATCO will then take some of the performance cars and even stuff that you may not conceive as a performance car onto a racetrack so that we can put it against the stopwatch and also see how it drives. And I think we just published your first one, which is on the A45S. And, you know, your insights into that car were amazing because to me, we drove that car on the road and I was sort of impressed with it, but you know, I felt like I was nowhere near the car's limits. You were able to take it to the car's limits. How did you feel behind the wheel of that and what sort of feeling did it give you when you drove it hard?
Yeah, it's an awesome little car and it's interesting because at the same time we had the Supra and they sort of inversed each other. That the A45 on the road was amazing, like really cool. I like that sort of the sound, the performance, the power, and the Supra. I was like, oh, okay, it's maybe not as exciting on the road. And I took him to the track, and it was slightly the opposite. Like it's, you can see, you almost start to build a backstory when you drive these cars. You can see where the engineering effort went in. You start to understand, okay, this is how they would have tested this car, developed this car, what tracks they would have used, what roads they would have used, and you can sort of build a backlog of how they got to a certain point. The thing with the A45 is that such a cool car. How they get that power out of that engine is mind blowing because its performance is exceptional. But it's not a full track car, so it had its limitations. And I think you could make it go further, but it's not what it's designed for. It's not an absolute outright track car, but an exceptional performance street car. And yet with the Supra, I actually really enjoyed it on the track and I was worried that I wasn't going to. And not that it was any quicker, but it just, the way the chassis was set up, the balance was actually where I could explore that rear-wheel drive was more fun on the track. both great cars, and I think we're going to find this all the way through, that everyone's going to have their strengths and weaknesses. And like you said, I'm keen to even put some pretty standard cars out there, see what times they'll do, and not just supercars and super quick hot hatches, but to go through the whole range and really build an interesting benchmark of what cars can do.
Speaking of hot hatches, ATCO, are you surprised how quickly the hot hatch segment has grown in popularity? These things are absolute weapons now with some crazy performance figures. Like, how much further can we possibly go with hot hatches?
It's blowing my mind. And you think I come in from a completely different world where I get my fix anyway. I get to drive cars that do 0 to 102 seconds regularly. And I don't really need that. You know, I don't need that outlet like a lot of other people do. So I'm used to driving the kids to school, you know, probably under the speed limit, just cruise along and do my thing. I'm more than happy with that because I get that outlet. And you can see why people want these cars because it gives such a rush. And the cool thing about the A45, you don't need to break the speed limit to enjoy it. Like, you just squirt it off the roundabout or something like that and it just goes, and you still could slow down a bit then, and it's like, wow, that was cool, and you get that rush. And like you said, the performance of these cars, it's been a few years since I've driven them, and it's crazy. Like, that's so cool. I'm sure you can stretch it a bit further, but now it's probably more refinement, and that's what I sort of get to in the story about the AMG, is that it really does a lot of things well, and now I think they're probably just going to refine everything. Like I said in the story, I think the electronics package, the way that they manage the slip control with that much power is really clever. There's a lot of good things about the car. And now it's probably, if they did the suspension and the geometry and the tyres to a top spec level, it would be so quick, it'd probably make the rest of the range of high-end performance cars look way too expensive, which I probably don't want to do.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, one of the, and we invite anyone that's listening, if you have any ideas for cars you want to see out on the track, email us at podcast@carexpert.com.au or hit us up on the site. Please send those through. But I would love, absolutely love, for Albors to head out on the track in that fancy yellow taxi of his, the Ferrari, and then for you to head out on the track in an electric car. Yeah. And nothing would please me more than him not being able to keep up with an electric car. That would absolutely make my day. So
you'd have to have the box of tissues ready at the end of the lap.
Oh, my God, that's so funny. Awesome. Well, look, if anyone wants to check out Chris's really cool performance review of the A45S, head to carexpert.com.au. ATCO, thank you a million for your time, and we're looking forward to having you on the podcast a little more often to talk about some of the stuff you've driven.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Good to catch up, and we'll speak again soon.
To give us our first review on Car Expert Podcast, Mike Costello, hello.
Hello, Mandy. A bit different to other times that we've recorded together because we're all sitting in different rooms.
Exactly. Actually, to give you some context, my cat is sitting right beside me as I'm recording this, and my actual microphone stand is a cat scratching post.
Okay, that sounds like peak Mandy.
Very much so. We are here to talk about cars, not cats. The 2020 Mitsubishi Majuro Sport GLS. You've written a review. Paul's actually did a video on this. Where are we looking at in the range for this one, Mike?
So the GLS is the mid-level variant, Mandy. The GLX is the entry point, and the Xceed is the range topper. So this one goes for $53,990 drive away, $6,000 less than the range topper.
That's actually pretty cheap. But the thing that sort of sits on my mind is, yes, it's $6,000 less than the range topper, but you then have to pay to get your extra for the seven seats. But the Xceed comes standard with seven seats. Do you think it's worth just spending the extra money for the Xceed, given the extra sort of gear that you get?
Well, I reckon that the Xceed is clearly the one to have because it has a couple of really good features. So it's got a big digital instrument display, which is pretty high tech with a really nice digital speedo. It's got proper sat nav as well as phone mirroring. And perhaps more importantly, it's actually got a lot of active safety tech that the other ones don't get. So every Pajero Sport gets autonomous emergency braking. But if you want blind spot monitoring, lane departure alert, cross traffic alert, you need to get the Xceed. And we're living in a world now where brands are understandably making lots of things options, but safety tech, I'm not so sure that you know, that should be something that's optional. So I think Mitsubishi A needs to get a bit of a kick for not making those features standard across the range. But I think I would be strongly suggesting someone go and get the Exceed if they're interested. And let's not forget that Mitsubishi is quite renowned for doing pretty friendly deals as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing with the Exceed. You get all the extra features and stuff. But if you then look at the pricing compared to an Everest Titanium or some of the other top spec cars, it is such good value for money. It's a versatile vehicle as well, because you've got the ability to basically run it in four-wheel drive on sealed surfaces as well, which you don't get on a lot of the dual cab utes that are based on these sort of SUVs. So, you know, it is good from that perspective. 3,100 kilos of towing capacity. Mm-hmm. What do you reckon about the design? That's been quite polarizing.
Well, they did an update at the start of the year, pretty subtle, but the front is certainly a bit more upright than it was. It's got a bit more of a sort of commanding look about it, a bit more of a macho look about it, in line with the Triton styling update. And those horrendous droopy taillights that used to be on the old car have been slightly reduced. So Mitsubishi's changed the rear bumper, which means that those sort of odd vertical-mounted LED rear lights are a bit smaller than they were. It's not the prettiest car out there, but to be totally honest with you, the target buyer for this vehicle that wants a capable 4x4-ready towing vehicle of that nature probably isn't super motivated by design. It's not particularly pretty, but I think it's a lot better than it was.
Did you get a chance to take it off-road, Mike?
Briefly, yeah. So Paul touched on the off-roading before, and that's probably one of the great things about this car, and same goes for the Triton that it's based on. Most of these body-on-frame SUVs that have low range, they either have, you're either in rear wheel drive or you're in 4H. So you're in 4x4, but that center diff locks and it's most useful for off-roading. But Mitsubishi's got an extra mode that has the open center diff that basically means it just becomes a 4x4 that you can drive on the road whenever you want. So if it's a bit slippery, if it's a bit, you know, you're on a sort of gravelly surface, it's snowing, whatever it may be, it can become a full-time 4x4. Off-road, I've driven the Pajero Sport off-road on several different occasions over different periods of loans over the years, and it is very good. Just like the Triton, it is a proper 4x4 off-roader. And, you know, compared to something like an Isuzu MU-X, it also has a locking rear diff, which is really, really handy. So if you are looking for a 4x4 that's not just a sort of, you know, soft roader, as it were, the Pagani Sport's definitely worth looking at.
Why can Mitsubishi do that and none of its rivals offer the same thing? Because I know the locking rear diff is something not everyone has, but that's not actually a part of the Super Select from what I understand. Correct. So what's Mitsubishi doing differently that the others aren't?
I don't think it's that they can't do it. I just think it's that they've obviously prioritised their R&D in other areas. Mitsubishi makes a big effort with its 4x4-ing technology. I mean, this system's actually quite old. It's not exactly cutting edge. But if you remember back to Mitsubishi's days with, you know, 4x4 rally cars, for instance, it always made a really big point of being a leader in that space. One thing that I'm really hoping for is now that Mitsubishi's properly integrated into that Nissan alliance, that we're going to start to see this great system trickle down to more vehicles across the alliance. And, you know, it is a bit odd to me that other brands don't do it. And I think it's even more useful when it comes to the pickups that are a bit obviously lighter over the rear with the Leaf suspension, because you do find that these sorts of vehicles with the wrong weather on a slippery road can get a little bit uncomfortable and squirrely, and sometimes those electronic stability control systems don't do everything you want them to do. So the fact that it's not in competitive vehicles strikes me as very odd.
Mm. How did you find the quality of the interior? Has that been updated lately?
Not particularly. Look, it's nothing flash. It's definitely, yeah. I mean, it's very similar to that Triton pickup again. It's certainly a step above the Isuzu MU-X, which is very plasticky and sort of feels a little bit cheap inside. In terms of tech, it probably trails that Everest, which is running Ford's Sync infotainment system. Pretty basic touchscreen that does phone mirroring. You know, the most of the plastics in that are pretty hard to the touch. There are a couple of sort of nice trims here and there to liven things up, but it definitely feels like a ute inside. But on the upside, it does have telescopic steering wheel adjustment, which an Everest doesn't have, so you can get comfortable. In terms of the cabin space, it's probably not the leader that a Prado or an Everest is. I noticed that, Paul, you're about 180 centimetres tall, I think, right? And you seem to fit in that middle row just fine. But if you're sort of a bit taller like Scott and I are, the headroom is limited. And then that third row is useless, really, for anything but, you know, little kids. In fact, I did say in my review that if you absolutely won't need that third row, just don't get it because it adds weight to the vehicle, it reduces the cargo capacity, and aside from little kids on occasional trips, that third row is kind of useless.
Hmm. You have given it a Car Expert rating of 7.8. You can check out the review now at carexpert.com.au along with Paul's accompanying video. Mike Costello, thank you.
Pleasure.
Hello, Tony Crawford.
Hey, Mandy. It's very nice to hear that familiar, professional, well-respected voice.
I think Crawford's being paid by the adjective based on that. Yeah,
I'm glad I'm not being paid by the hour to get reviews done. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
Well, you've got a review coming. Well, it's actually out right now as this podcast is live on the Audi RSQ3. How did you find it?
Yeah, look, that we actually, the whole event was basically showing off the new wave of Audi RS models by Audi Sport, who are the guys that, you know, produce the Monster RS6 and the sports car R8 and the RS7. So we were in the RSQ3, and I don't know whether you remember the previous RSQ3, but it was a bit of a terrible thing. It was too small to be any use as an SUV. It had god-awful proportions, really, too high. Went quick, that's for sure. But the new one is a completely different vehicle entirely. And I would say it's closer to an Audi Q5 in its proportions than the old Q3 was, which was really quite small. It is one of my favorite vehicles. I mean, we drove everything that day, and there'll be more reviews coming in the coming weeks. And RS6 was a brilliant vehicle. It's now got rear wheel steer, that sort of thing. But the RSQ3, I would call it, particularly the Sportback. So before it was just RSQ3 SUV. Now we have a Sportback version, which rakes the roofline down much farther than the standard RSQ3. So you have your choice, basically. And there's about $3,000 difference, you know, less is more. So that's what you're paying, about $92,900 versus $89,900, that sort of thing. It's just a brilliant vehicle, goes like the clappers, handles amazingly. In fact, we were so far up the RS6's bumper that it was kind of embarrassing. That's how quick this thing is. It'll do 0 to 100 in 4.5 seconds flat, speed limited to about 250. I'm sure it'll do about 280. The grip is astonishing for 255 section tires, and they're not wide by any stretch these days, but this thing has unbelievable grip. The comfort factor is incredible. I think they're going to do really well with this new RSQ3. I think the Sportback will be preferred by most buyers, but I haven't got a bad thing to say about it, frankly.
Tony, what's the noise like? Is it as good as the outgoing one?
100%, guys. It has that RS exhaust, sports exhaust with a flap. It sounds amazing. In fact, I was just working the gears. You know, it's a 7-speed dual clutch, and we were just using those gears up and down the gear ratios just for the fact of changing that gear and how quick it is to engage in a lower gear, then back out of a corner. It was the most fun I've had, I have to say, in since COVID started, let's just say.
So, Crawf, it's still a 5-cylinder. Does the new car have any more power than the last one? Because it sort of seems like not much has changed under the bonnet.
Yeah, look, it does have a bucket load more. Grant's got 294 kilowatts now and 480 newton meters. I think you'll find that's quite a bit more. I believe we got to about 274 with RSQ3 Performance, which came out, I think, in 16. Don't quote me on that one. But 294 kilowatts, 480 newton meters. It even feels faster than 4.5 seconds, 0 to 100. It just gets out of a corner and grips up like you wouldn't believe. I mean, bear in mind, you know, for 92.9 for the Sportback, the same sort of performance can be had with a Porsche Macan turbo, but you'll be paying 140,000 or 142,000. So if you look at it that way, it's quite the bargain given its size now. It's kind of in the middle too. I mean, there are no real direct rivals to this car. You'd have to say sort of the GLA 43 or the, which is smaller again. And then if you went to the X3 or the GLC, well, they're both larger again. So I just think it's a really convenient size. Now, the only downside of people buying the Sportback over the standard RSQ3 is you lose a bit of rear headroom. Honestly, Scott, you would probably not be comfortable in either of these vehicles.
It's not comfortable in anything.
It must be quite the physical disability. Like even watching your head walking through a doorway. Don't go to a castle and stay at the Nürburgring because you're quite likely to be in some pain.
At risk of taking us off track and talking about cars again. The GLA 45 will get the same engine as the CLA 45 you drove recently, and you loved that car.
I did.
Head a little bit. How do you think the two will stack up?
The GLA, is it not smaller in...
So the new one will be a similar size to the Q3. I don't know that they're identical dimensionally, but they've both grown. And the new GLA is going to be a more of an SUV shape than the old one, which was a bit of a hatch on stilts.
Yeah, I think there'll be plenty of buyers for both of these. I think Australians love performance SUVs, and I think Audi have got this one pretty much bang on. We're yet to see the Benz, but I've always been impressed with the Quattro system as well, because we got a chance to drive these in pretty poor conditions in regional New South Wales last week, and it really just does hang on. You really don't have to slow down in the wet. That's what I just can never believe that with Quattro. It's just phenomenal. Footprint in whatever conditions, and I think that's a safety aspect for me too, which is why I'd love to get one of these. I'm really calling the particularly in the new colours they've got these eight. It's a colour palette of eight, and the Kailami green, which is my all time favourite, with black pack wheels, 21 inch. This thing just looks like a baby Urus, and that's kind of what I've been telling my mates that you should go and buy, because it's just, I don't know. I mean, I can't think of negatives at this point. Obviously, I've got to come up with a few. There's always something that quite gel, and I know I'm always pressed to come up with negatives. I've got a bit of a reputation for saying nice things about cars, but only because I love this thing. It's just, you know, I would buy one myself. Put it that way. So,
interesting.
Ready and willing. It's just seems to me to be so much more than an RS3. Which I know it shares the same engine, but an RS3 Sportback to me just doesn't have the flexibility, the high riding aspect, and I don't think this gives anything away because you are up a bit higher. It just seems to hang on. And I was driving it with another guy, another journo, and he was in the we're either swapping between Sportback and standard RSQ3, and honestly, I couldn't pick the difference between the two on the road. It's just the look, and you don't really notice it at the start. And someone sort of pointed it out that, you know, that's the Sportback, and only from the C-pillar back do you actually get any difference. Otherwise, they're identical from the ground up. They've even got the same cargo capacity behind the rear seats. It's only when you fold them flat does the standard RSQ3 get a bit more cargo space.
Well, we better let you go and finish that review, Tony, so we can actually read it.
I'm quite panicked. when I heard Scott on the phone, I suddenly got quite panicked and a cold shiver.
If he doesn't file it at a reasonable hour tonight, I'm going to be jumping on my girlfriend for working too much.
Can that reasonable hour be like front of that? Can we say a reasonable hour of sort of 9 p.m.? Is that
a, we can have this conversation off the air.
All right. Oh, now I'm nervous. Okay.
The following RS models will be at carexpert.com.
Yeah, see you later, guys.
Very soon. Thanks, Croft. Bye.
No worries. Bye.
That puts an end to this week's podcast. Paul, what's been happening on the site the last few days?
Oh, look, Mandy, it's been a busy few days. We've got those great news stories that I mentioned earlier, plus some reviews worth checking out, including one from Pat Devereaux, our international correspondent. He's just reviewed the Mustang GT500, which... I so want to have that car here. It looks awesome and it sounds incredible as well. We've also got a review on the Skoda Superb Scout, which is one of our new long-termers. That car is fantastic and very much looking forward to seeing what it's like over the next few months.
And Scully, what's coming up on carexpert.com.au?
So next week we will have, starting from Monday, we're going to have a Toyota Mirai review with a video. Paulie and Igor were out filming with Toyota's fuel cell sedan, which I'm very much looking forward to. We're also going to have a review on the Ford Ranger FX4 with a video, the Audi Q8. Kurt's been driving that up in Sydney, and I'm very curious to hear what he thinks. And then we've also got some Toyota Corolla content going live. So covering all ends of the automotive spectrum.
Excellent. Well, this has been fun, gents. It's really good to have the team back again, and we'll probably hear from you very soon. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. And if you guys have any feedback or have any questions, podcast at carexpert.com.au is where you can catch us.